Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today we woke up to news of another black man killed by a police officer, so we decided to change today's show to talk about the latest killings. In light of these new developments, we'll talk about these high-profile shootings, and we're going to talk about what happened and open the phone lines to get your reactions. On Tuesday, Alton Sterling was fatally shot by police officers outside of a convenience store in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He was selling CDs at the time, and we're getting breaking news about what happened in that case. And then on Wednesday, Philando Castile was shot and killed by a police officer just outside of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And his girlfriend live streamed the aftermath on Facebook. The video shows her boyfriend covered in blood as an officer points his gun at him. She said he was shot as he reached for his driver's license. She also said they were pulled over for a broken taillight. So we're going to talk about these cases, how they're being investigated, how do they fit into the larger conversation about police use of force, particularly toward people of color, and now that this is getting so much attention, why does this keep happening? Today we are joined by Kevin Litton, a reporter for the Times-Picayune in Louisiana, and he has been extensively covering the shooting and killing of Alton Sterling. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Kevin, I want to just spend a couple minutes with you. Are you still at the police station there in Baton Rouge?
Yeah, we're reviewing records from the police files, personnel files of the two officers that were involved.
Okay, so can you give us an overview of what happened to Alton Sterling on Tuesday?
So the incident began with a phone call to police that there was a man who had a gun and who had threatened someone in the parking lot of a grocery store in a neighborhood in North Baton Rouge. When police responded, they encountered Mr. Sterling. There was an altercation that ensued, and according to police, during that altercation, the officers fired their guns at Mr. Sterling and killed him. I think what happened after that is that videos were released that weren't official videos. They were taken by people on the scene, and what you can see in the videos is that there was a struggle with Mr. Sterling on the ground, and that the officers at some point pulled their weapons out after yelling that they had spotted a gun on Mr. Sterling. So while police haven't confirmed that Mr. Sterling had a weapon on him at the time, it appears that that was the concern if you watch the videos.
And I understand that you live in an open carry state, right?
An open carry state? I'm not really that familiar with firearms laws here, but certainly Louisiana has one of the highest gun ownership rates in the nation.
Right. And CNN posted some breaking news this morning that it was actually a homeless man who threatened to rob Alton Sterling. He was selling CDs in front of the convenience store. The homeless man said that Alton Sterling showed him a gun because some of his friends who also sell CDs have been robbed recently. And then the homeless man called the police, and that's why they showed up. Is that right?
The report that I read from CNN, and this was around 9 a.m. Central, was that the homeless man had been asking Mr. Sterling for money, and Mr. Sterling had grown tired of him asking for money and showed him the weapon to kind of say, get out of here, I don't want to mess with you anymore, and that the homeless man was the person that called police. Mm-hmm. From my reporting, from what I understand from his family, they were very skeptical about whether or not he would carry a weapon with him. They didn't think he did, but if you talk to folks in the neighborhood about the nature of what Mr. Sterling did, which is selling CDs and DVDs after dark, sometimes past midnight, in a neighborhood where you could encounter some problems, they weren't surprised at all that somebody that is on the street that much would carry a weapon.
What has the reaction been like in Baton Rouge? There have been a lot of protests, a lot of rallies. Can you talk about that?
The first night that I covered the protests was after the first video had been released, and you could really get a sense of very intense anger at what was being seen on the videos. Those protests carried on peacefully into that morning, though they were disruptive to traffic. I didn't witness any property damage, and there's been no violence reported associated with it. By the time Wednesday came, they held a press conference in the morning demanding action on this from Mr. Sterling's family, which which many people saw, which was a really heartbreaking scene that included his son breaking down in tears during the press conference. Mm-hmm. Shortly after, the governor held a press conference, announced that the Department of Justice had been involved, and by 6 p.m. there was a vigil, which kind of turned into a protest. But at all points, there was a call for nonviolence. Mr. Sterling's family has called for nonviolence, and so far, that's what we've seen. So peaceful yet disruptive protests, and at the vigil, the family and community leaders, elected mm-hmm. officials, all urged not just nonviolence, but to respect towards police officers and to not be disruptive to traffic.
Can you give us a sense of what it's like there in Baton Rouge? NBC News reports that Baton Rouge incarcerates blacks at twice the rate of whites, and Louisiana is the third poorest state in the country. About 20% of the population lives below the poverty line. The city of more than 230,000 has all the hallmarks of a place on the edge, according to this piece. It's split on racial lines with sprawling swaths of poverty and islands of prosperity. It's majority black, but that group doesn't really have access to quality jobs, education, or health care.
Well, Baton Rouge, I think, it may be close to majority black. I'm not sure if it's reached that demographic level yet, but most of what you're describing is what I hear and what I cover the legislature when I'm not doing stories like this. And what you commonly hear is the concern about Louisiana being the incarceration capital of the world. There's more people locked up in Louisiana per capita than any other place. And there's a lot of concern about the policies of the past and how to fix those going forward. Certainly a large portion of that population is black that's in prison, and that has had, you know, really tough effects on communities like the one where Mr. Sterling was killed. I mean, he himself had been locked up at least twice from the records I saw. He had registered as a sex offender in 2000, and one of the policy concerns that everybody's looking at now is the difficulty that people like Mr. Sterling have in getting employment, getting decent housing, and being able to reach beyond the opportunities that may be stifled in a neighborhood like the one he was from. So I think that the thing to know about Baton Rouge is that it's an extremely divided city. I mean, I covered Baltimore and lived there for 7 years, and Baltimore is certainly a city I would describe as divided, but Baton Rouge is even more starkly along those lines, where you really see things start to change as you cross a major thoroughfare, where it's like, you know, once you cross this thoroughfare, it is predominantly black community, and it's not very well, it's not really very diverse in other neighborhoods the way that Baltimore is. So I think a lot of people had expressed concern at some of these shootings that happened in other places, that Baton Rouge was a place where there would be unrest if a police shooting like this occurred, and they were certainly concerned that in these large areas of poverty that that the police activity was something that could cause some issues. But I will say, between Baltimore and Baton Rouge, I think, you know, Baltimore had a long history of brutality. Baltimore had it's difficult, I think, in Baltimore to find people, African Americans, that would have good things to say about police. When I was interviewing people in Baton Rouge during the protest, I asked some people, you know, have you had negative interactions with police? And they said no, and they could name police officers by name that they had relationships with. I said, did your friends or family have those interactions? And they said they didn't. Others certainly had, but I think those kind of reactions would have been much more difficult to find in Baltimore.
Kevin, where does this go from here?
Well, what we're told is that the investigation could last as long as 4 weeks, but that was from the district attorney. And, you know, I think as these videos show, there is really some difficult calls that have to be made about what the officers were doing and what they saw. I think there's a lot of controversy over what's seen in the videos, and that's what they're sorting out now. So I think going forward, there's probably going to be some time for protests, and I think the political leadership in Baton Rouge, we have a mayor's race coming up in a few months, and I think this is probably going to play heavily into the political sphere. They were doing voting registration out on the streets where the protests were taking place, so I think there's certainly going to be a big political discussion around this to come. And I think the governor's priorities as far as incarceration reform, criminal justice reform, are probably going to loom large when we open the legislative session next year.
And the two officers, where are they now?
Two officers are on administrative leave, so we haven't really been able to contact them. So right now, I think most reporters are working on what was these two officers' histories in the department. They don't have long histories. They were 3 and 4 years, respectively, experienced. They're young guys. So we're just trying to figure out who they were and whether there was anything in the past that would indicate something, you know, like this happening in the future.
Well, Kevin, thank you for taking some time to join us.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you. That is Kevin Litton. He's a reporter with the Times-Picayune in Louisiana. He is joining us from a police station there in Baton Rouge, and he has been extensively covering the police shooting and killing of 37-year-old Alton Sterling. He was shot and killed on Tuesday night outside of a convenience store in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where he was selling CDs at the time. Again, in this area, there's an extremely high unemployment rate, a very high poverty rate, and we're getting more information about what happened to Alton, actually, as we speak. And then on Wednesday, 32-year-old Philando Castile was shot and killed in his car right outside of St. Paul, Minnesota. His girlfriend live streamed the aftermath on Facebook, and the video has been seen over a million times. It shows Castile covered in blood as an officer points his gun at him. And she said they were pulled over for a broken taillight. She said he was shot as he reached for his driver's license. So because this just happened over the last 48 hours, we decided to change today's show to focus on these latest killings. And if you'd like to call in and express your thoughts about this, we're talking about, you know, why does this keep happening with video now? I mean, almost so many of these shootings are now being videotaped. So what are your thoughts about this? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Ron Davis to the show. Ron is the father of Jordan Davis, the 17-year-old Florida teen who was fatally shot by 47-year-old Michael Dunn in 2012. Hi, Ron. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, Ron, sorry we have to have you back under these circumstances. I mean, is it safe to say that when these shootings happen, you relive what happened to Jordan?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I get calls and texts from people all over the country. So as soon as this happened, of course, people that know our story and know that I'm an activist fighting against this violence, you know, on people of color, they will either send me a Twitter or a call or either text and let me know what's going on. So I knew about it right away, what was going on down in Baton Rouge. And then the next day, I find out what happened in Minnesota, you know. So, yeah. It hits you hard because of the fact that it affects so many people, and the people that it affects, they always get in touch with me or other people that are out here trying to protect the community.
So the family members get in touch with you to figure out what steps to take next, because when we've done shows about this, these killings, so many family members have come on saying, so in some cases, we feel powerless if we don't get a lot of media attention and we just don't know what to do next.
Sometimes that is the only way to get law enforcement to do their job diligently. You know, they try to sweep things under the rug, and what happens is, you know, you as a family member, unless you're, you know, you voice your opinion, unless the news comes, you know, like in Baton Rouge now, because CNN and some other stations are down there, you don't get the news, and so therefore you don't get the governor, as he's done in Louisiana, to call the Department of Justice. And now in Minnesota, they've called the Department of Justice also. So without the news and without the radio, without people getting upset and showing, you know, how they feel, like I think the first night it was 100 protesters, then it was 200 protesters. You know, without that, then it swept under the rug.
Ron, we were able to get Kevin Litton, a reporter, on the line to talk about Alton Sterling. Philando Castile was shot the next day. Can you talk about how we get the information in these cases. And I guess what really struck me in watching the girlfriend of Philando Castile, I mean, she Facebook lived this. It was she had a video of right after the police officer shot Philando Castile in this car. She went live on Facebook. And she was talking about how he's never been in a gang. And we talked about this with you on the show, how a lot of the family members almost feel like they have to come out and talk about how they were, you know, good fathers, good brothers, for example. So can you talk about how this plays out and how it's very similar with a lot of these killings?
Yeah, because, you know, Philando, that happened the next day. You know, the first thing that came out in the first case in Baton Rouge was, you know, whether, you know, this person had a criminal record. The first thing they said about, you know, Alton was he had a criminal record. You know, he had been in jail previously for, I think he had a 5-year sentence. So when a family member sees these things come out about another kid or another individual, then the first thing they want to do is protect their child, you know, and so that's why they have to use video and all these other things and saying how he was a good man. You know, according to all accounts, you know, he was worked in the school system. He was a cafeteria supervisor, never been in trouble. And so they have to come out and say these things, you know, because already I know that for Alton's sake, all this negative stuff is coming out already. I've already read so many things about how he has a long list of a criminal record, but you never say anything about the good things that happened, you know. So Philando, I think that, you know, his parents are doing the right thing. His mom, Valerie, is doing the right thing. All his neighbors and everybody is coming out talking about how he helps the kids and how, you know, he had a job at Target before. He's been working since he was 18 years old. You have to say all these things because you want to bring value to your loved ones. See, and that's what law enforcement a lot of times is try to victimize the victim. You try to make sure that the public knows that this person wasn't of value, so you shouldn't walk and protest in the street because their life wasn't important, and we're here to say that his life was important.
That is Ron Davis. He is the father of Jordan Davis, the 17-year-old Florida teen who was fatally shot by Michael Dunn, a 47-year-old white man. We have had Ron on the show many times talking about what happened to his son, and I hope you can see the documentary that looks at his case in depth, 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets, and you can find the trailer online. And now I would like to welcome Michael Denzel Smith to the show. Michael is a contributing writer at The Nation magazine and author of Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education. Hi, Michael. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Michael, I went to bed last night and read about Alton Sterling. I woke up this morning and read about Philando Castile. In these cases, now we have the video and we know what happened. We see what happens. Why does this keep happening, even though there's so much video out there and social media out there that lets people know exactly what happened? It's no longer sort of a he said, he said. We can actually see what happened.
Well, I mean, it's showing people that it's happening. People have to care that it's happening, though. And I think that that's the problem, is this gap of empathy. I think that the video evidence is important in one respect, that we are documenting this, that we know that it is happening. But the problem is that for Black communities specifically, we've known that this is happening for quite some time. For people who give deference to police in these situations, all it does is retrench them in their position that, you know, all you have to do is cooperate with police and nothing will go wrong. If you weren't doing anything wrong in the first place, the police would never bother you, and so on and so forth. But even for the people that would be more sympathetic to watching, and I mean white people in this instance, white people who would be sympathetic to seeing these videos and believe that something has to change, I think that so often what it does is it reaffirms the distance from their own lives, that they can watch this video and they can see that that's that thing that happens to Black people over and over again. It's not a thing that happens to us as a society. It's not a thing that happens to us as in community with one another. It's the thing that keeps happening to Black people, and it's tragic. But it doesn't force people to have new ideas around why police do this, Whether or not police should be interacting with communities in this way, whether or not we should be giving police license to kill in the way that we do. And it keeps happening partially because we don't want to fundamentally alter the role of police in our communities. We think that we can train police out of this in terms of like sensitivity training, diversity training, getting more black people on a police force. The problem is that the fundamental function of police does not change. They are there to impose inequality. They are there to reaffirm hierarchies of citizenship, to demean and denigrate and dehumanize black communities. That's the function of police. And if we're not willing to address that, all we're doing is watching in these videos the police doing exactly the job that they've been told to do. So why would anyone change it?
Mm. Can you elaborate on that a bit and talk more about changing the fundamental function? Because we have had so many conversations about this. I mean, every news outlet is now talking about these issues. But most people believe that you have to change, for example, the way that police interact with people, or racism training, for example. Can you talk more about that?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, the problem, though, is that changing the way that someone interacts with police or police interact with communities still is predicated on that interaction, and you still have a lethally armed person interacting with the community on the basis of what exactly, right? So, you know, Philando, they were stopped for a broken taillight. Now, why do we need armed guards to handle broken taillights, right? Like, what is it about that requires a gun on a person? We talk about, like, Eric Garner. We're talking about a man selling loose cigarettes. What about that interaction needs a police officer with a gun? You know, we talk about, like, Michael Brown walking in, like, the pretext for him being stopped in the street in that moment before all of this about stealing from the store, but he's walking in the street, he's jaywalking. What about that interaction? What about that action needs an armed police officer? You know, you have within communities the idea of quality of life policing, of broken windows policing. What we're doing is increasing the moments in which already marginalized and oppressed and paranoid, fearful communities are increasing their interactions with armed guards. So we have to ask ourselves, why do we think we need to do this to these populations? The idea that we're stopping some greater crime from happening, that we're stopping some type of violence from happening by enacting another form of violence on people. If we were to shift and we were to think about the ways in which to actually solve the problem of violence within communities, where we don't place this pathological blame on black communities for the violence that exists in their neighborhoods, and we say that we have failed, we have divested resources from these communities, we have failed to build infrastructure that would offer people venues for self-expression and for the building of self-identity and self-esteem, that we've poisoned people's water, we've taken away homes, we've taken away schools, we've denied people opportunity for the betterment of themselves, and then we wonder why they're violent, and then we sick police on them. So we have to, I mean, it's like fundamentally thinking differently about policing, but also about the way we structure society, because we ask police we foment social decay, and then we ask police to go in and fix it. And that's just backwards thinking.
Michael Denzel Smith is contributing writer at The Nation and author of the book Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education. We're also joined today by Ron Davis, father of Jordan Davis, the 17-year-old who was fatally shot by Michael Dunn, a 47-year-old white man, Jordan Davis, a young black man. And I hope you can watch the documentary 3.5 minutes, 10 Bullets, which tells Jordan's story and his family's quest for justice. It also really gives you an incredible behind-the-scenes look at what happened during the trial. We decided to change Your Call show today to focus on the latest police shootings. In the past 48 hours, two more black men have been shot and killed by police. 37-year-old Alton Sterling was shot and killed on Tuesday outside of a convenience store in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And then on Wednesday, 32-year-old Philando Castile was shot and killed in his car in St. Paul, Minnesota. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience you'd like to contribute to today's conversation, our phone lines are full, but when one frees up, you may call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up in a half an hour at 11 o'clock, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will be discussing coverage of the massive suicide bombing in Iraq, which left more than 250 people dead. We'll also be joined by Shane Bauer, Mother Jones reporter. He'll talk about his in-depth investigation into the private prison industry. For 4 months, he worked as a prison guard at Wynn Correctional Center. That is a private Louisiana prison run by Corrections Corporation of America. He will join us to talk about his experience, what he saw, and the reaction to his reporting. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the latest police shooting. In the past 48 hours, two more black men were shot and killed by police. And today we're joined by Ron Davis, father of Jordan Davis, the 17-year-old who was fatally shot by Michael Dunn, a 47-year-old white man. The story of Jordan Davis and his family's quest for justice is seen in or shown in the documentary 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. We're also joined by Michael Denzel Smith, a contributing writer at The Nation and the author of Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have full lines, so let's hear from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Okay. I couldn't agree with Michael Denzel Smith more. I think poverty in this country is tacitly approved by white people. It's okay. It's racism, you know, that I think as white people we are complicit in. We are sitting back feeling okay with the poverty, the violence against people of color, as long as we have gated communities. I've gone to my neighborhood police association meetings in North Oakland, this liberal town, and the concern is about the thugs walking the street. Mm-hmm. They're the people who are calling the police. The police were more open to restorative justice than my so-called yuppie neighbors. And I have acquaintances and relatives who are posting, who are completely apathetic generally, but are upset about the lack of gun control and, you know, people are shot, young kids are shot, but saying nothing when people of color are killed by police. I mean, this could not happen without the complicity of white people. We are complicit in this. We agree to this. It is normalized. Every time we walk down the streets in Oakland and see people who are poor, sitting on the streets, homeless, we are tacitly agreeing to this. And, without disarming the police, I really don't see a solution. Without really calling each other out, I don't see a solution. Mm. I think this is a huge, huge problem. I really appreciate you talking about this.
Well, thank you for calling in, Lisa. Ron Davis, what are your thoughts? I think a lot of people feel the same way as Lisa, that this just keeps happening. Is there a real solution?
Does. Yes, it does. You know, I was just looking at the Alton Sterling case. You know, they talk about his record, but they don't talk about the police who shot him. And I was looking at Howie Lake, and it shows that he had a previous shooting of an African-American male also, and he was placed on leave. But see, they're not talking about that, you know. So this is not the first time he shot an African-American male. you know, we see these cases time and time again. I know in the other case of LeVar Jones, which was in Columbia, South Carolina, where they showed the video of the guy, the policeman told him to get his ID, his driver's license. He reached in the car to get his driver's license, and he starts shooting him in the back. You know, fortunately, LeVar Jones lived, and fortunately there was a video of that, you know. And he actually had to plead guilty to that, the officer. And he was one of the few, he was a state trooper, South Carolina state trooper. And they still have not sentenced him, but he did plead guilty, and they settled the case with LeVar Jones for $285,000. But see, it all goes back to the system protecting itself. You know, you have a system in place that if you take a policeman and say that you're going to prosecute that policeman and show wrongdoing, but then the city has to pay the family of that person. Well, the city does not want to pay, and so the police do their best not to prosecute and not to arrest the officers. And that's what's wrong with the system right there. You know, you can't police yourself, and we see this time and time again. And if you notice that the young lady that is live streaming what's going on, it's a shame that we as American citizens are so fearful of the police that every time we get stopped, we have to live stream or we have to videotape the police because we know that, you know, the death is upon us. You know, the police is supposed to be there to protect us, but instead we are fearful of the police because of all the actions of the policemen across this country.
Mm. Ron Davis is the father of Jordan Davis, the Florida teen who was fatally shot by Michael Dunn, a 47-year-old white man. And you can learn more about this story and what happened behind the scenes in the courtroom by watching 3.5 minutes, 10 Bullets, and a really incredible documentary. When Ron was on the show last time, he said if only every person who was killed had a documentary about them to learn more about their lives and what happened. And now I would like to introduce Jamiles Larte. Jamiles is a reporter with The Guardian who extensively covers police shootings. Hi, welcome to the show, Jamiles.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. I know you can stay with us for just a couple minutes, but I wanted to talk with you about accountability because Ron Davis just brought that up. Can you talk about why it is so difficult to hold police accountable? And in these two cases, for example, you've got two officers who were involved in the fatal shooting of Alton Sterling who are on paid leave. I'm not sure about the officer who killed Philando Castile, but what about accountability?
Sure. Well, so there are a few barriers to accountability. First and foremost, in most cases, is that, you know, the only evidence that we have or the only account that we have of what happened is the officer's own account. So that's always going to make accountability difficult. When you only have one version of a story, usually that story sounds more or less the same. One of the next things that tends to come up is the way that these shootings are investigated. So in December of last year, we did an extensive look at all of the shootings in 2015 and who was investigating them, in some certain percentage. It was the department where it had been committed. In other places, it was, either an outside department or someone a level up, like a state investigator or someone on the federal level. And there's been legislation introduced slowly in different states to encourage or to force departments to do things like that. But often these departments are investigating themselves, or they're being investigated by colleagues, and there's sort of a unspoken, I scratch your back, you scratch mine, law enforcement looks out for each other attitude. Then the sort of the final stage of accountability is, when you get to the level of a district attorney or a prosecutor who's going to at some point say that, announce charges, and those relationships too are colored by the fact that police work with district attorneys and prosecutors every day, that 99% of their interaction, they're considering themselves as being on the same team. So even if you don't have to have a malicious prosecutor who's just sitting there saying I'm never going to prosecute a cop and I always take the cop side, it doesn't have to be that overt. what you see is a gentle, subtle bias, that law enforcement was probably right and that the person on the other end of the gun was probably wrong. And that colors, the ability to hold people accountable.
Does the video ever make a difference? Because 5 years ago, we didn't have the video, and now we do. And we just got an email from a listener about Philando Castile. Again, on Wednesday, Philando Castile, 32-year-old, was shot and killed in his car in Minnesota. His girlfriend went live on Facebook. For those of you who don't know, there's a new feature on Facebook, and you can go live. So I could right now videotape myself doing this show, and you could watch it in real time, anybody who's connected to me on Facebook. So she went live on Facebook right after he was killed. You see his body with blood, and she's describing what happened. And so one of our listeners just gave us some facts from this New York Times article. Both of them had their hands in the air. The officer asked for Castile's license and registration. As he reached for his wallet in his right back pocket, the officer said, "I have a firearm on me." The girlfriend, Lavish Reynolds, then shouted that he was licensed to carry the weapon, which adds even more complexity to all of this. And I'll ask Ron about guns, especially in these open carry states. The officer then shot Castile 4 times, and Lavish Reynolds' 4-year-old daughter was in the car and witnessed the shooting. Now, as the girlfriend, Lavish Reynolds, is handcuffed, she still has Facebook Live happening. And so the question is, so many people wonder, do these videos actually matter?
Yeah, let me be like unequivocal. Video continues to really be the pivot on which most of these cases turn, in the sense of, video is usually the operative thing in terms of a case, between a case being ignored and a case becoming a hashtag and becoming national news and getting picked up, by outlets for spawning protests, all of the things that we've seen in the last 2 days with these two cases. So for example, the director of the FBI, James Comey, right now is in a congressional hearing, and he was asked whether or not these shootings are happening at an alarming rate, and he said yes, which is true, but it's also not true in the sense that it's happening at a historically consistent rate. So I mean, if it's alarming, then it's always been alarming. It's not more than it was before, nor have there been, some greater amount happening this week as opposed to last week or the week before. What we're seeing this week in the fact that national attention is switching back to this issue so profoundly is, in both cases, very graphic, disturbing, evocative video. Where unlike what I was talking about before, where in many cases the only story you have is the official account that police provide, we have this other version that we can interpret for ourselves. Video is enormous.
Well, I know we have to let you go, but thank you for joining us, Jamiles.
Absolutely. And you know what, let me before I go, I would like to just touch briefly on the open carry
right,
concealed carry aspect of this, just because it's something that we did write about. Do we have a minute?
Yes. And so just let me know if I'm giving out correct information, because a lot of this is just coming in. So Alton Sterling reportedly had a gun in his pocket. He was shot in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Louisiana is an open carry state, right?
Yeah. So I just wanted to be clear so people understand exactly what that means. Open carry means, it doesn't mean that anyone can carry a gun at any time in any way that they want to. Open carry means that you can openly, as in visibly, carry a weapon around as long as you're the legal owner of that weapon, and there's, you are legally able to purchase it. So if you have a gun in your pocket, as Sterling appeared to, at the end of that video, it appeared that we saw police officers removing it from his pocket. What he was doing was concealed carry in the state of Louisiana, which you do need a permit for. I called the Louisiana State Police, and they would not tell me whether or not he had a concealed carry permit. But again, the punishment for illegally carrying, illegally concealing a weapon is not the death penalty on the spot. So, that is not an excuse or a reason for him to be shot. The only reason, from speaking with law enforcement professionals who watched this video and, gave me their two cents is, ultimately, is that firearm a risk? So is there the potential, the immediate potential and that you cannot interrupt by any other means for him to get a hold of that weapon and to use it either against one of the officers or against a member of the public? And so when you watch that video, and you try to make a decision about the use of force, whether it was justified or whether it was not, that's ultimately what you're trying to figure out.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you for that information, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jamiles Lardy is a reporter with The Guardian. He's been extensively covering police shootings. We're also joined by Michael Denzel Smith, author of Invisible Man and contributing writer at The Nation, and Ron Davis, father of Jordan Davis, the 17-year-old who was fatally shot by Michael Dunn, a 47-year-old white man, in 2012 in a convenience store parking lot. Learn more about Jordan Davis in the documentary 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. Ron, I want to ask you about this because I think this is really important. You've been on the show in the past, and we've talked about the NRA and gun laws. So if states are going to pass these open carry laws, and you have police say they feel like their lives are threatened because these people have guns on them, how do you deal with this? If someone has a gun legally on them because these states are passing these laws, and a police is brought into a situation, for example, for Alton Sterling, who was selling CDs, if his gun was legal, how are they going to deal with this?
Well, first of all, I'm going to be, you're speaking about our film, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. We're going to actually have a screening in St. Louis, and this is going to be on the 16th of this month, next weekend. So on the Saturday the 16th, we're going to be up there for the National Bar Association. When all this happened, I got a call from Benjamin Crump, who is the president of the National Bar Association. We're going to be talking about this next weekend. But just to let you know, there's a difference between open carry while white and open carry while black. And I don't think your listeners heard me. I just want to let them know, open carry while white is different from open carry while black. Ro, you understand that?
I've seen video that proves that. People have done tests. Yeah.
And here's the difference. Here's the difference. Because even though you have open carry in your state, the guideline for a police officer is this: did the victim pose an imminent threat? Well, that's subjective, okay? Because when you look at things like John Crawford in Walmart in Ohio, which is an open carry state, he's in a store that's selling guns. So he's looking at the merchandise, and it was a BB gun. But the police went in and shot him, even though the BB gun was not pointed at them, even though it was an open carry state, but he open carried while black. And people don't understand the difference. There were some other kids that came in a few weeks later in a Walmart, actually, and had BB guns that were shooting the BBs up at the ceiling. And they were just arrested. They were handcuffed and taken out of the store. They were not shot. So this is what we see over and over again in this country, that, it's not so much the law, it's the implementation of the law. And that's what we're having a problem with law enforcement, because when they see people of color, they see danger. Mm. No matter what, they're not going to stop and ask you if you have a permit. They didn't ask Alton whether he had a permit for his gun. They wrestled him to the ground immediately, and they had his arms really secured by the legs of the police officer, so he couldn't really grab a gun, but they shot him in the chest anyway. So the gun that was down in his pocket, which it took them a few seconds to actually get it out of his pocket, was not the issue. The issue was that they didn't think that his life had any value.
Well, I want to try to get to a few more callers before we end, because a lot of people have been waiting patiently. So let's go next to Mike in Oakland. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So a couple of things. I think, not to echo other callers, but, you know, first, I think that the introduction of social networking and our access to videos has just broadcasted something that has gone on for ages. And now, you know, obviously the outrage is justified, but now that we have such, you know, more access to social networking and videos, we're just finally seeing it. And secondly, I've seen all these things about, you know, Alton's criminal record and it taking value away from his life or his, you know, stance as a citizen. And I just really believe that, you know, if I were to go out and shoot someone that had a criminal record, I'd still be charged with murder. And the fact that, you know, these police officers are hiding behind the shield and using the fact that he may or may not have had a criminal record as an excuse to take his life is just ridiculous.
Well, thank you for calling, Mike. We'll get a response in just a few minutes. I want to take a few more phone calls. Let's go next to John in Oakland. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Heard you at the top of the show asking, why does this keep happening? And I was reminded of a book by a man named Derek Jensen, and the title of the book is The Culture of Make-Believe. And he touches on what the person said a moment ago about the implementation of the law and how in our culture, just going back for decades, there's violence towards there's so much violence and hatred, and just we have a history of it in our culture, going back to the days of the genocide of the Native American and so on, and then right up to the present with the way we treat the environment. We have such little regard for the environment. And his message in this book is how this has just carried over, and we've been living this for so long, we don't see it. It's part of our culture. And one last thing I'll say, he wrote this book 14 years ago, and he makes references to, he's got about 5 pages where, I'm sorry, I'm kind of emotional, but where, for example, Edward Anthony Anderson, January 15th, 1996, shot while handcuffed on the ground. Here's something that might sound familiar to people in Oakland. Keisha Miller, December 28, 1998, shot 12 times after being startled awake while sleeping in a disabled car. That something like that happened in Oakland recently, and this goes back to 1998. But anyway, I would recommend having Derek on, Derek Jensen. I think he can answer these questions about why this keeps happening.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, John. Michael, we have just a couple of minutes. I feel like we've been asking these same questions. Last year, we had a weekly series on police, community, police shootings. I mean, we had so many conversations about this. Where do you, as someone, you just wrote this book, A Young Black Man's Education. The book is called Invisible Man. We're going to have you on soon to talk about your book. But where do you want this conversation to go?
Well, let me just say Invisible Man got the whole world watching. I don't want anyone thinking that I wrote Ralph Ellison's classic Invisible Man. The conversation for me is taking it out of the hands of black people to keep explaining our humanity. I think that we've done that over and over and over again. And I think that what we have to note is that our humanity has really never been in question. It's the humanity of the people who keep taking our lives whose humanity is in question. Are they humane? Do they see value in other people? Can they change their lens to note that black lives matter? I think that it really is incumbent upon white people to have these conversations and to stop waiting for the next fresh body to gawk at to stand up and to speak out, to keep doing this work constantly, because it's being done in the service of white supremacy. And I think that, you know, people think that they don't think of themselves as white supremacists, therefore they don't, that's not their issue. But white supremacy, meaning the valuing of white lives over the rest of us. This violence is being done in service of that. This violence is being done in the names of white people. So when do white people have these meetings? When do white people have this reckoning about what violence is being done in their names? And when do they say enough is enough?
Ron Davis, what about you? You're doing this full time now. This is what you've dedicated your life to. After you lost your son in 2012, you're getting phone calls from family members who seek your advice. Where do you want this conversation to go?
I received a call from one of the boots on the ground, one guy that's down on the ground in Baton Rouge that are in touch with the family and know what's going on down there. His name is Arthur Reed, and he's an activist in Louisiana. They call him Silky Slim. And he was a gangbanger, and he turned his life around a few years ago, and now he has a program called Stop the Killing, and it's a nonprofit. So he's down there, and he's the one that's in touch with me every hour. Basically, he'll text me something that's happening down there. So that's another person for people to get in touch with down there is Arthur Reed, who was nicknamed Silky Slim. But the way I see it, and I hope I never live to see the day that this has to happen, but as far as law enforcement is concerned, the only way to stop what we're seeing today on a daily basis is to actually, if you have an African-American community, then your policing is going to have to change and become African-American. Because the only way that I can see now, I mean, we have to admit that we are a racist, biased society. You know, we didn't want to admit that. We want to be America the Beautiful, but we're not. So since we're not that America the Beautiful, when you have a community that has 60, 70, 80% African Americans in that community, then the policing in that community is going to have to start being African American. Mm-hmm. If it's a Chinese community, then you have to have Chinese in that community. And that sounds like, oh, that's awful because of the fact that that sounds racist. But you know what? African American police have mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers that are African American. So when they look at that black boy and they look at that black child, they see their family members. They're not so quick to pull the trigger. And the same thing with other communities. The Chinese in Chinatown, they're not so quick to pull the trigger because they can see their family members in that person. And this is the way that we might have to operate society. It's unfortunate, but that's the way you may have to operate society, is that if you have an overabundance of a certain nationality, then that police force should reflect that.
Ron Davis is the father of Jordan Davis, the 17-year-old who was fatally shot by Michael Dunn, a 47-year-old white man, in a convenience store parking lot in 2012. See the documentary 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets, which tells Jordan Davis and his family's story. Michael Denzel Smith is author of Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching. He's a contributing writer at The Nation. Ron and Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.